Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Ramir Bearden once said that he never left Charlotte except physically. Bearden was correct on both counts, as many of his late career paintings and collages make clear, including a series of works called Mecklenburg County. Bearden's is a familiar name in Charlotte these days, even among people who know nothing of his status as one of the most influential artists of the 20th century. In 2013, Ramir Bearden Park opened, not far from where the future artist lived with his parents and great-grandparents in Uptown Charlotte. As for his art, it is now prominently displayed as part of the permanent collections of the Mint Museum and the Harvey B. Gantt Center for African American Arts and Culture. For decades, though, the Charlotte-born artist was little known or mentioned here. He grew up in Harlem and Pittsburgh and came to prominence in Harlem. But Ramir Bearden was born here in 1911. He moved with his parents to New York in 1915 as part of the Great Migration. His parents, Howard and Bessie, were, like so many Black Americans of their generation, forced out by rampant white supremacy and segregation. The upheaval of violence, racism, and dislocation became part of Ramir Bearden's psyche and helped fuel a fertile blend of memory and imagination that inspired his exuberantly experimental art. It is this story, the intertwining of Bearden's everyday life with his prolific and propulsive creative output, that takes center stage in a new biography by Glenda Gilmore. She became familiar with Bearden's story when she lived in Charlotte, a time when, as she says, the city's influential residents finally discovered their native son, whose family was victimized by earlier generations of Charlotte elites. Glenda Gilmore is professor of history emerita at Yale University, and she joins us today. Glenda, good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
And Glenda, I guess for you, it's afternoon, right? You are in Ireland.
It is afternoon, but good morning to you.
Thank you. The name of your book is Ramir Bearden in the Homeland of His Imagination, An Artist's Reckoning with the South. What do you want to say and convey with that title?
I want to point out, first of all, obviously, that his work is vast. And in the end of the book, I focus mostly on his Southern work, particularly on the work that he does in North Carolina, because that was nearest and dearest to my heart. But at the same time, so many people have taken Bearden's work as purely autobiographical. The Charlotte Mecklenburg Public Library, once beside the big mural in the lobby there, once had a little plaque up that said it was the view from Bearden's mother's cabin. And of course, Bearden's family was a prosperous African-American middle-class family who owned three houses on Graham Street and a grocery store. There was no cabin. They were urban. So Bearden had a smattering of memories, not in any linear order, collage-like even. And those memories came back to him as he painted. He used some. He was also an expertly trained artist, and he cited other artists, old masters to modernists. So I want to establish from the beginning that it's not the real South. It's not his autobiography. It is what his imagination and the sum of his experiences can tell us about the South.
This biography includes reproductions of many of his works, sort of creates a dual verbal visual portrait of how Bearden's life experience fed his artistic life. And you write in the book that some things about Bearden's work are impossible to put into words. And with that in mind, I'm wondering, how challenging was it for you to sort through and decipher memory versus imagination, which you just alluded to, for an artist who openly said he didn't know where his memory ended and his imagination began?
This was a real struggle. And I'm a historian. I'm not an art historian. So my stock in trade is getting the facts, lining them up in chronological order, and making an argument out of that. I want to prove something when I write a book. My other monographs are extremely historical. So this was a huge challenge. I ultimately came to the point after finding out a great deal about Bearden's background, about the things he knew and the things that he didn't know. I know more about his ancestors in some ways than he did. I finally came to a point where I realized that his imagination, what he thought about his work, what inspired him to do his work, was just as important, if not more important, than all those facts I had lined up, like Drain's and Bearden's work. And I needed to recognize that and write about that. Ultimately, I also came to the point that I realized that he invites you, the viewer of his work, in to use your imagination.
You mentioned that you are not an art historian. You're a historian and an expert on the Reconstruction South, Jim Crow era South. But I'm wondering, as you deal with art in the book, as you obviously have to with an artist, how did you go about learning about artistic technique and influences and materials?
At Yale, where I taught for 25 years, I was in the history department. And then I started thinking about writing this book in the early 2000s, but about 2007, 2008, I sort of migrated to spend most of my time in African American studies at Yale, where we had the art historian Cobina Mercer and the poet Elizabeth Alexander, Hazel Carby, a literary critic, people studying music. And in that small and really vibrant department, we shared our work, we learned about each other's fields, and we taught in an interdisciplinary way. So I learned a great deal simply by opening up the doors of, they don't call it a discipline for nothing. History is a discipline. And it disciplined me after several monographs into sort of a straight up, just the facts man person. But in the end, being in FM and doing interdisciplinary studies liberated me. Also, I worked for about 5 years on two separate Afro-American art history searches. And then, you know, you can learn things. Went to a lot of museums, tracked Bearden all over the world, and really worked on his art.
That is the voice of Glenda Gilmore. She is the author of the new book, Ramir Bearden, In the Homeland of His Imagination, An Artist's Reckoning with the South. We're talking a little bit about your blend of learning the art world at the same time that you are or have been a professor of African-American history, and you've written several books about Reconstruction and Jim Crow era Southern history. I can't even speak, I apologize. But what I wanted to ask you about is, you know, in this book, you definitely put that expertise to work. As you said, you go back multiple generations, and you really start this story with Ramir Bearden's great-grandparents, Henry and Rosa Kennedy, who came to Charlotte after the Civil War. They have a fascinating story, and it's not the one that I think a lot of people would expect. Introduce our listeners to Henry and Rosa and what they were able to do when they came to Charlotte.
Thank you for that question, because as I worked on them, they became a centerpiece of the book. Romery lived with them until he was 4 or 5. We think he left in 1915 to go north after a traumatic incident that we'll talk about later. Henry Kennedy and Rosa Catherine Gosprey Kennedy had met in Augusta, Georgia, during the Civil War. Henry Kennedy was enslaved to Major John Kennedy, who's the founder of Chester, South Carolina. And he came from County Antrim in Ireland. And in 1845, he one of the people who's enslaved to him is a mulatto baby. He, from there, Henry is sent by Major Kennedy to a family in Augusta, Georgia, right after Fort Sumter. So it's difficult to know what the major's relationship was. He was almost certainly family with Henry Kennedy. He's either his father or his grandfather. So when the Civil War breaks out in South Carolina, he sends Henry to Augusta to Thomas Woodrow Wilson's father, Joseph Ruggles Wilson. And
as in future president Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, yes. As in future president. And Woodrow is, who was known as Tommy, is five when Henry Kennedy gets there. Henry Kennedy is 16. He is enslaved. He's a house servant. Woodrow can't read and write until he's nine. He doesn't learn the alphabet until he's nine. Henry Kennedy is literate when he arrives. So it's quite the juxtaposition. He marries Rosa Gosprey, whose father, acknowledged father, was a white Portuguese carpenter in Charleston. And somehow after the war started, they too got to Augusta. Henry Kennedy becomes spectacularly successful as a railway mail clerk, a federal employee. They run several businesses in Charlotte. They run a grocery store. He has a taxi. They take in boarders, own rental houses. And so they're extremely established people.
And they're not living in, just to, I'm sorry, just to interrupt you very quickly. Yeah. This is a result of both Reconstruction, obviously, but also what you're saying is they're very successful. These are urban people. They're not living in a cabin in the country.
Not at all. I think Henry Kent, the family's making about $2,000 a year, which was as much as more than public school teachers made, white public school teachers. And so they're quite prosperous. They're also leaders in their church. They're Amy Zion people. Rosa is active in the Woman's Christian Temperance Union, which is the anti-alcohol organization. And I first saw her in the Charlotte Observer when I was writing my first book, Gender and Jim Crow. And I thought, I wonder if she is, you know, related. And her daughter is named for her, Catty Bearden, then becomes vice president of the WCTU. So they're a fascinating family.
They are, and that is how they are the reason that Ramirez ends up spending his first 4 to 5 years in Charlotte, because his parents come back. They meet in New Jersey, they get married, and they come back to where Ramirez is born. So they come back in part because of the stability of the great grandparents. Correct?
That's right. That's right. And they also have so much room. You know, they live in a Victorian house with two other houses beside them. They have the grocery store. Bearden's father, Richard Howard Bearden, who went by Howard, is meant to manage the grocery store. And so that's what they're starting out. His mother, Bessie Bearden, joins the Black Episcopal Church, which has most of the leaders of Charlotte in it. The Amy Zion Church is fine, but the Episcopal Church is the Society Church.
Let's leave that as the cliffhanger. We'll pick up the story after this break with Glenda Gilmore, and we're going to talk about what Ramirez Bearden experienced in his brief 4 or 5 years in Charlotte that would influence his art for the rest of his life. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is Glenda Gilmore. She is professor of history emerita at Yale University, and she is the author of Ramirez Bearden in the Homeland of His Imagination, which has just been published. I should mention for our listeners, we're going to talk obviously about Ramirez Bearden's artwork here in these next two segments, and if you go to WFAE.org, /Charlotte Talks. We have links to look at the works of Ramir Bearden. And also we will be putting that on social media on Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And of course, you can always go down to the museums here in town and see his work. And so, Glenda, I apologize. I interrupted you there. A little bit of a cliffhanger. So his parents, Ramir Bearden's parents, have made it to Charlotte. Their son is born, and you were saying that his mother, Bessie, really becomes involved with one of the more influential churches here.
Yes, the All Saints Episcopal Church, which is the where the Black doctors and lawyers, one lawyer in Charlotte, one Black lawyer at that time, go, and it has a kindergarten, which he attended as he got to be 3 or 4.
I want to go back for just a moment with his great-grandparents, Henry and Rosa, because they are the link and thread throughout your story, and really a link to the greater African-American experience in the South. And one of the things that you mentioned is that Ramir Bearden's name comes from his great-grandfather. It was a friend of his great-grandfather's, and the family pronounced it Ramare, and I think you may have pronounced it that way as well. Tell me a little bit about how the pronunciation has varied over time.
Well, he never corrected anybody because it's just a good policy not to correct anybody pronouncing your name. They called him Romery.
Romery. Okay.
Romery. He says that's the way he spells it out phonetically. And so he was named for a man who was a friend of his father's. I am uncertain whether it was the mulatto's son, Paul Fred Romery, or his father, who came from Sweden to be a bank clerk in Chester, South Carolina, and had a son with a Black woman.
So a lot of this book, you were just talking about, first of all, the misconceptions that have persisted over time, that the Beardens were living in a cabin, that they were off in sort of the country. But you paint a full picture of what Charlotte and Mecklenburg were like during his youth. And it was an interesting blend of, while they were in the city, of course, it was a different time. So seeing chickens in someone's yard was not unusual. Seeing gardens, prominent gardens, was not unusual either. But I want to let you paint the picture a little bit. When he looked out from his great-grandparents' porch, or when he accompanied his great-grandfather on rides around town, what was he seeing?
You know, even in my lifetime in Greensboro, there were plenty of urban gardens. And in Charlotte, most people who moved into town, white or Black, many people would have gardens on their lots, and not just flower gardens, but certainly flower gardens and also vegetable gardens. Chickens were completely legal. The neighborhoods in Charlotte at the turn of the century, the one on Graham Street, 401 Graham was their house, where they lived, was an integrated neighborhood. Magnolia Cotton Mill was across the street. There were all sorts of industries that were growing up on South Boulevard. And the main Southern Railway train ran behind Magnolia Cotton Mill. So if he stood on his front porch, he saw the main line of the Southern Railway and an elevated train trestle that came from South Boulevard over what's now Bank of America Stadium and connected with the main line so that people on South Boulevard manufacturers could ship their goods, you know, the half mile, 2 miles that they needed to. Uptown was downtown. And it's still subject to controversy, but they lived, as you would know, if you live in Charlotte, they lived about 4 blocks from Tryon Street. So they're able to walk downtown. His grandfather's taxi, his hack, which he did in his off hours, was horse-drawn. So there were horses, even in 1910, 1915. the whole part of what he was doing with the taxis, I guess I could say that Charlotte was just a little bit wilder in some ways than you might ever imagine. Carrying a gun on your hip was legal. Carrying a concealed weapon was not. So people were walking around armed. And Dilworth was just the suburbs, the inner city ring suburbs were just getting started. Dilworth was down South Boulevard, theoretically far enough away to be away from the manufacturing. And the town was not strictly segregated. It became completely segregated block by block by 1920.
So you mentioned earlier that the family left as a result of a wrenching episode in 1915. What happened?
Bessie and Howard Bearden and Remery walked up to the main part of town. She was shopping. He was minding Remery, and Remery got away. Now, to understand this story, you have to know what Romery looked like and how Bessie dressed him. He was very, very light skinned. He had long curls, long blonde curls that Bessie had not cut, shoulder length. And in those days, as hard as it is to believe, young boys of upper class families were dressed in dresses with little stockings and Mary Jane shoes. They were dressed sort of like girls. Woodrow Wilson was too, so I don't know if they got this from the Wilson family. They would be breeched when they were about four or five, first with shorts, and then they would get long pants. So there he was with Romery running away, maybe on Tryon Street, and he runs to catch him. And a white mob gathers around him and thinks that he, a black man, he's darker than his son, is kidnapping not only a white child, but a white girl, a little white girl. And so the mob tries to take the child away from him. Bessie Bearden comes charging out of the store, and she has a lot of authority in most of her life, so I imagine she did then. And the mob lets him go. The Beardens go home. They make plans to move to New York.
That is the voice of Glenda Gilmore. She is the author of Romere Bearden in the Homeland of His Imagination. We should probably talk about art since we're talking about Romere or Romery Bearden. Now I'm going to be confused how to say his name, but bear with me.
It's okay with him.
Again, if you want to see some of his work, we have a link at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. The first work I want to ask you about, and again, many of these are in your book. It's great because you can look at the art as Glenda Gilmore is explaining to you what's going on and how it was influenced, is a series of works about a character named Maudell Sleet, who is a hybrid of someone who Glenda has sleuthed, probably lived near the Beardens, and someone who is a little bit of Romere Bearden's imagination. But the works are paintings and collages that were done later in Bearden's life, and they all focus on this woman and her garden. What did you take from those works in particular? Why were those important in his overall body of work?
He does, there at the height of his power of collage, he goes through several other artistic practices before he becomes a collagist in the 50s and particularly in the 60s. And also, I think they're incredibly successful. I loved, for example, Sunset and Moonrise with Maudell Sleet, a 1978 collage, because it reminded me of women going out to tend their gardens in urban and inner suburban locations. Bearden says of Maudell Sleet that she did live near them So we know it's an urban garden, despite the fact that you might not be able to tell that from the art. So she had a garden. When I passed, she was always giving me something. She was a very nice lady, a very powerful woman. She kind of symbolized the earth, someone with an intimate relationship to it. And here she stands in sunset and moonrise with enormous hands. For Bearden, that means she's very powerful, powerful person. She's gone out. Sunset and moonrise in the South is so sweet. It's that moment, you know, when the lightning bugs start and you're just ready, whether you're a kid or whether you're sitting on the front porch with a G&T. And so she's gone out. It's the cool of the evening. And that's when people worked in their gardens. They couldn't go out in the heat of the day. Many of them worked. And she's got all sorts of wonderful things in her bushel basket, little carrots, sweet little cucumbers. And he does, she's wearing a straw hat. Women always wear hats in their gardens. So he, in the last painting, which is Summer, Mauldale Sleet's July Garden, which he did in 1985, the oral historian who chronicled his life, Myron Schwartzman, says, well, in that last Mauldale Sleet painting, she's not even in the painting, just flowers and birds and vegetables. And Bearden says, that is Mauldale Sleet. So to me, it's I believe that Bearden took from Charlotte a firsthand and deep sensual feeling of nature that he didn't get either in Pittsburgh, where he lived for about 3.5 years of his life off and on, or in Harlem. And so his natural world is very much based in red clay and very much based in Charlotte.
And you mentioned earlier, you know, the family home was uptown. The Good Samaritan Hospital, where he was born, is where Bank of America Stadium sits right now. And one of the funniest lines that I enjoyed the most is near the end of the book, when you're talking about some of the actual locations and their proximity in modern Charlotte. And you say that Mauldale Sleet's garden sat where Bank of America Stadium was built in 1996. And you write, quote, "I'm convinced that one Sunday afternoon while watching a Panthers game, I'll see one of Sleet's squash vines sprout on the 50-yard line, and it will grow magically, monstrously, until it covers the field," end quote.
You don't doubt that, do you?
Oh, not at all. And I also think it might benefit the Panthers based on recent seasons. So.
No, I know. The heartbreakers.
If you can make that happen. But I'm also curious, what do you think of, you mentioned in the book, Ramir Bearden Park, which, by the way, includes a little garden in tribute to Mauldale Sleet. What do you think in terms of his prominence around town these days? And we'll talk a little bit about the exhibit late in his life, but just in general, what do you think of contemporary Charlotte and his place in it?
You know, it was so interesting to write this book, because living in Charlotte from 73 to 94, I got to see people buying prints of Bearden's work, the museums collecting Bearden's work. Bank of America, which I think it could have been even NCNB when it started in 73, but Nations Bank, et cetera, started buying Bearden's work as an investment. And they have donated a lot of that. They made a market that supported his work and supported him. And of that, we should be very proud. When you become iconic, you're kind of that kind of blurs who you really are. And he's become iconic in Charlotte, I think. I'm not sure it's still to the extent that it was. I would love to see, he went back to Charlotte in the 80s. And, you know, all of this is gone. Everyone who thought that way is gone. Charlotte was shocking. He couldn't get oriented. Charlotte would be shocking to me now. You know, I'll be there in October. It continues to grow. And a lot of the diversity that we had, a lot of the natural environment that we had, even in the early 70s, is lost. And so constant progress also constitutes loss in some ways.
Well, and one of the things about this book is, I think, and I've lived here almost 30 years, but there were many things I just simply didn't know. It recaptures a lot of the history that many of us didn't see. So I think it's valuable in that respect as well. I want to ask you about the physical aspect of his work, particularly as he gets into collages and different materials. It's not simply brush on canvas. What was that like? What did that take out of him to do that? Because he was a pretty prolific artist.
I do want to mention that he starts as a cartoonist and he draws lines. When he's young, he does cartoons for the NAACP magazine, The Crisis, and other places. He has 2 years of formal art training at Boston University, graduates from NYU. So he's a trained artist. He studies with a German person fleeing Germany, fleeing the Holocaust in the 1930s, who says that he invented photomontage, which is collage, but he did invent a lot of that kind of modern Dada stuff. Then Bearden moves through social realism. He moves through abstract art. At the same time, all of those things are really good for collage. He makes collage as a painter. He paints and he paints on the collage. Ultimately, he did a lot of watercolors when he was traveling. He did watercolors during World War II, but he had to have a great deal of equipment and a big space and clippings.
Let me just interrupt you, and we're gonna create just a little space, and then we're gonna come back and complete that thought with Glenda Gilmore. More on Ramir Bearden coming up next here on Charlotte Talks. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We're continuing our conversation with historian Glenda Gilmore. Her new book is Ramir Bearden in the Homeland of His Imagination, and it has just been published. And Glenda, I'll let you pick up. You were talking about watercolors and all of the things that would need to be toted around as Ramir Bearden moved into collage, but you take the story from there.
Ultimately, he had to have a big studio, and he did that in Long Island City. He went to this big room every single day, maybe not on Sunday, but he was a constant artist. But it's very physical work. It involves cutting, pasting, and he did a lot of things in a very large format. He also does small collages, but he was in terrible pain. His back hurt for years, but it turned out that he had bone cancer, and he hired an assistant at the end of his life whom he directed to make collages based on his own vision, Bearden's own vision. And his last one was made just a few weeks before he died.
Yeah, I was going to mention he worked really up until his death. He was born, as we mentioned earlier, in 1911. He died in 1988. And you alluded to this a little bit. He did not start off in collage. He started off as a cartoonist. And then even as an artist, he went through multiple phases. He considered himself a cubist first and foremost. And I would ask you two things. One, share with us what a cubist is in terms of the style of art, but also if you could expand a little bit on Bearden's lifelong frustration with being boxed in. He didn't like art to be segregated in any way, not just race, but the types, styles, influences. Where did that come from?
He actually ended up with a certification as a math teacher. He's a math person. So he always drew, he always painted for from the time he was a child in Pittsburgh, but he has a kind of geometrical outlook on life, a kind of rectangular sense. And he studied all the old masters, but in the hands of George Grosse, who was the German at the New York Art Students League, he learned to draw with a reed pen. He learned to draw lines in a certain way. And he became, in that process, he says, I was always a cubist. Cubists use rectangular, triangular, they use lines, for example, Picasso, Georges Braque. And he has that as the basis for his art, whether he's working in oils or collage, probably less so with watercolors because he does those, you know, on the, when he's traveling quickly, wherever he is. His social realism is very much like Diego Rivera. It seems a little derivative, but Bearden believed and declared that Black artists did not have to be confined to 19th century landscapes or traditional ways of painting to prove that they were good painters. They could be modernist as well. And he spent the 40s producing highly acclaimed abstract art with Samuel Kutz, who was also Picasso's American agent. And so that was the height of his success before collage. He just, as abstract art, abstract expressionism got more abstract and turned into what they called the intrasubjectives, where you don't have to paint anything that represents anything other than your internal feelings. Bearden didn't want to do that. He wanted to represent things, and but he didn't want to be confined about what it was that he would represent. Mm-hmm. So he abandoned abstract art in the 50s, had a period of depression, and emerged working in collage.
An important point I should mention is, you know, I think those of us who are familiar to any degree with him in Charlotte and elsewhere, we think of the latter stages of his life as he becomes, you know, renowned. He becomes a name. He's successful. He's a man of means. But for many, many years, he was not. And you write about how he was a social worker in New York for almost 30 years. So he is balancing a full-time job with his art. How do you think success changed him, if at all, other than giving him a lot more time to work?
Absolutely. That's an interesting question. He was always an artist. He was always convinced he was an artist. There was no shaking that. He didn't need acclamation in order to be an artist. He did like it. It was an inspiration of itself to create a body of work on which he could build. However, he said when in the 30s, when they started the Harlem Artists Guild, there were 50 Black artists in New York, and Bearden was surprised by that number. So shows, even in New York, were not integrated shows at galleries. So he broke through that in the 40s with Kutz, and then later with his other representatives, Cordier and Ekstrom. But it was in the 60s and 70s and 80s that he reached people. He always wanted to reach people, and he reached a wide audience of white and Black people, people of all sorts. He said he was a universal humanist. He wanted to speak to everyone. He wanted his art to speak to everyone, which didn't mean that he didn't represent the Black experience, but he truly believed the Black experience could speak to everyone.
That's the voice of Glenda Gilmore. She is the author of Ramir Bearden in the Homeland of His Imagination. It has just been published by UNC Press, and I can tell you I have a copy. It's a beautiful book, not only for the words, but for the artworks that are sprinkled throughout it. I want to ask you a little bit about an interesting aspect of influence, which is I never knew that Bearden paid tribute to Cézanne in some of his Mecklenburg works, no less. How did he do that?
He loved Cézanne, that sort of forerunner of Cubism, a person who starts that way. And when you're in Cézanne's studio, you look out, you see what's in most of Cézanne's paintings, which is Mont Saint-Victoire, the huge peaky mountain right outside of Aix-en-Provence. And so often Bearden will have Mont Saint-Victoire in a Charlotte Mecklenburg scene, just sort of sitting up. You look out the window and you
see that. It sits just behind Bank of America Stadium. A lot of people may not see that, but it's there.
Well, you know what's kind of interesting, though? When I was standing in the front yard of 401 Graham Street, which was a parking lot, when I was standing there where their house was, there's some hills sort of northwest over the railroad track up there. The hills start. They don't call it the Piedmont for nothing, you know.
That's true.
And so I think what happened was in his memory, I think that's a grand example of how his memory of those hills blends with his perception of Cézanne and Mont Saint-Victoire.
And it seems to me that part of his frustration and admirers of his with this idea that he was simply drawing on memory, not that there's anything wrong with that, is that it takes away the imagination of the artwork that he's creating. It diminishes it a little bit.
Thank you. That is an argument in the book. I could argue that is an argument. Yes, it does. It doesn't credit him with all of his study, all of his art study, all of his references, his citations to other artists. It doesn't credit his skills, color and lines. It just implies that he saw this stuff and he can render it to you, when instead he's a million times more playful than that and deeper.
Well, I think another point that is important in your book is that not just Ramir Bearden, but the generations of his family that you depict, these are people of excellence and achievement. For example, his mother, Bessie, is a pioneer in so many ways in Harlem. She's a political figure. She's an educational figure. She hosts these salons with Duke Ellington and all the major writers and artists. These are not people who just kind of tripped over success and handed it off to Ramir. So tell me a little bit about that, in terms of maybe some people have missed out on the achievement of this family dating back generations.
People, so they're very known. Bessie Bearden writes the weekly column, the Harlem column for the Chicago Defender, which is the largest Black newspaper in the country. She's the deputy commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service for New York City. She works on campaigns. She meets with Eleanor Roosevelt. She
at the White House.
At the White House. She's smart. She decides when she gets to Harlem, women have the right to vote for the first time. And she decides she'll become a Democrat. Harlem has been Democratic, but it's changing from white to Black. So she's able to become the most prominent Black woman Democrat in New York and a confidant of Mary McLeod Bethune, et cetera. So in the book, I argue that each generation's achievements are lost by the posterity that follows them. So there's a story about Bearden, Connie Mack asked Bearden if he wanted to play pro professional baseball and said he could if he passed for white. But Bearden could never pass for white. People know who his people are. Yet in all this discovery of Bearden, it's white people discovering Bearden. Black people knew who he was. He was a pallbearer at James Weldon Johnson's funeral. He's very prominent. So I think that your line of vision is everything. And if you see him as someone, poor boy, poor Charlotte boy makes good, you see certain things.
You also wrote that the Charlotte, you were here, let me back up. You were here when a major exhibit, the first major exhibit of his work came to his hometown, correct?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I wasn't. Okay. I moved there in 73, but I was there because I was living at Paris Island and came back. I wasn't a Marine. I was married to a Marine during Vietnam. And he's from Charlotte, so we would come back during the weekends.
Well, I wanted to ask you, so in the book, you write about this major exhibit at the Mint Museum, the original on Randolph Road, and you note that the Charlotte Observer wrote at the time that this exhibit of Bearden's work would rescue the Mint from anonymity, and your observation follows, and it is this, quote, "The irony of Bearden rescuing the Mint Museum from anonymity when his parents had been chased out of Charlotte and he had spent decades in relative anonymity could not have been lost on him," end quote. In the remaining couple minutes we have, how do you think he reconciled those contradictions? Because I think you note that he thought about skipping the opening. This was not an entirely peaceful homecoming, let's put it that way.
Right. The great Lou Powell of the Charlotte Observer wrote those lines. So there was a lot of, Bearden was really touchy about this. He knew exactly what the Mint was. It had only recently been desegregated. And when Milton Block, who was the director of the museum, called him an expatriate, Bearden felt as if he was disowning his status as a Charlottean. And Bearden answered the director, "I never left Charlotte except physically." So there was some tension. He said he wasn't going to come to the exhibition, but he got went to Brooks Brothers and he got a new tuxedo and he came. Mm. And it really, I think, meant a lot to him and gave him the confidence that he needed to produce such great work for a large Southern audience.
So is your best guess that he had made peace with Charlotte by the end of his life?
Yes, I think so. I think that Richard Mishaw of the Charlotte Observer took him to Henry Kennedy's grave. I think he had made peace with Charlotte. He did very much like the fact that Charlotteans were interested in his work and were buying his work. But Bearden wasn't fooled by, you know, he also understood the time and place. He understood the limitations of those possibilities as well as the fulfillment of them, I think. He understood that Charlotte had a long history of racial trouble. Harvey Gantt was mayor when his work became so popular. So,
first African-American mayor of Charlotte.
Right. The first. That's right.
And I guess to bring it full circle, Ramir Bearden's artwork now hangs in the African American Arts and Culture Museum that is named for Harvey B. Gantt.
Right. That's right. And that's wonderful. And he would have liked that.
Well, we will let that be the last word. But of course, if you want to know more, you should go take a look at Glenda's book. It is called Ramir Bearden in the Homeland of His Imagination, An Artist's Reckoning with the South. Glenda, thank you so much for joining us today live from Ireland.
Thank you so much, Eric. It was great fun.
For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks so much for joining us today on Charlotte Talks. Have a good day, everybody.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.